So it is an extreme pleasure to have Renato Renner as our colloquium speaker this week. Renato studied physics at EPFL in Lausanne and at ETH Zurich, where he received a degree in theoretical physics. He then completed his PhD in the computer science department at ETH with a thesis on security of quantum key distribution, for which he received the Best Dissertation Award by the German chapter of the Association for Computing Machinery and the ETH Medal for the PhD thesis. After his PhD, he spent 2 years in the UK, where he was an HP Research Fellow at the University of Cambridge. In 2007, only 2 years after receiving his PhD, he started as an assistant professor at ETH Zurich, where he has been full professor since 2015. Renato's interests are very broad, spanning from quantum information science and quantum thermodynamics to quantum foundations. He has made seminal contributions to the field of quantum cryptography, and he has also asked deep questions about the foundations of physics, for instance, on clocks and the nature of time. We are very much looking forward to Renato's talk. Whenever you want to start, the floor is yours.
Yes, thank you, Flaminia. So I would like to thank you and all the co-organizers also of the workshop that is taking place this week at PI for inviting me. It's really an extremely nice kind of set of people that you brought together because they are studying time from such different perspectives. And I'm also very glad to talk here actually at this PI colloquium because I think the PI has one of the highest density of people who are actually deeply thinking about this notion of time. My, let's say, rather modest contribution to this field is that I'm trying to give another angle on this whole topic, namely the angle from information theory. So Flaminia has before mentioned some of my work I did, and I think the common feature of all this work is that I was always using information theory, in particular quantum information theory, to attack questions either in physics or maybe in applications when it comes to quantum cryptography, for example. Now, the goal of the talk today will be not very technical, but I hope nevertheless deep, or at least I'm trying to be as deep as possible, is to explain to you, first of all, how information theories think about problems in physics, why it can be interesting to actually take this perspective. So information theorists usually have pictures like this. We have an Alice and a Bob. And this just shows one important feature of information theory. Information theory is always about agents or some, I mean, the word agent is not so important, but I call them agents holding information about something else. So usually we have at least in some way two subsystems of the world. One is the system that holds information, but the information is always about something, and this is another part. Here it's just Alice and Bob, and this picture shows a scenario that we will encounter a bit more in this talk, where, for example, Alice has a clock, and you could ask yourself, how much information can Bob have about that clock that is in Alice's hand? Now, a lot of this research that is at the interface between quantum information theory or information theory in general and physics is motivated by, let's say, early work by several important people. And one of them is Landauer. There are others whom I'm not going to mention everyone, for example, Gibbs and so on. But Landauer was particularly influential, in my opinion, because he kind of made it possible to bring together very different aspects of thermodynamical aspects that looked very different, but one talked about entropy and information theoretic aspects, which are also about entropy, but Landauer somehow helped us understanding how the notion of entropy fits together. So what was Landauer's approach? Maybe it's best summarized by this slogan that you see here, which I think is really due to him, which is the slogan that information is physical. What did he mean by that? I think what he roughly meant is that information always needs a physical carrier. There's no abstract information. Information is always encoded in a physical system. And therefore, if we process information, if we ask ourselves, what are the possibilities of processing information? What are the boundaries of processing information? We have to take into account the physics of the information carriers. And you could even say that this is not only a bound, but this also offers new possibilities. And quantum information is actually one of the, one could say, implications of this slogan, that you really take serious the fact that information is encoded in systems. These systems obey the laws of quantum theory, and therefore these quantum laws have to have an influence on how we should think about information and led to the discovery that quantum information behaves quite differently from classical one. But Landau was actually not concerned about quantum so much. And one example that I just want to bring as a start to set the stage, which doesn't have much to do with time at this point, is what is maybe today known as Bennett-Landauer erasure. The idea here is that we just want to think about a very simple operation that we could describe in purely information theoretic terms. So the operation is just we get a bit, which can be 0 or 1, and let's suppose we don't know what it is. And the only goal of the operation we want to execute is that at the end, the bit that comes out has the value 0. So erasure is maybe not the best word. I call it here a resetting. So we want to take an arbitrary input and make it deterministic, and the deterministic value is here 0. Now, if you take Landauer's slogan serious, then you have to ask yourself, is this really a physical operation that you carry out, that you can carry out? And if yes, what are the resources you need? And what Bennett and Landauer realized is that if you really want to carry out this operation, you need to look at it in a thermodynamic context. And if you do so, I mean, that follows from this principle, from this slogan. And if you do so, you realize that this is an irreversible operation. And in order to be compatible with the second law, you have this operation must be of the kind that it consumes some work. So you have to put in ordered energy, if you like, and it dissipates some heat. And one can even make this quantitative. Here is the formula. It depends on the temperature with which this mechanism that carries out the reset operation is coupled. Now, actually, one can generalize this, and this then makes it clear what I meant before. One can actually ask, what happens if you input here some information with a given information theoretic entropy? And then you can ask yourself, how much does the entropy of this reservoir grow, at least during this operation? But when you now talk about the entropy of this reservoir, you may think of the purely thermodynamically defined entropy, which is defined as by essentially the amount of heat that flows into this system divided by the temperature. And it turns out that the law then tells you that the entropy that comes in will be a lower bound on the entropy increase of this reservoir. So the information theoretic entropy is kind of translated into, if you want, thermodynamic entropy. And if this process is optimal, then it's even an equality. And this really, at the end, tells us that the let's say, old-fashioned thermodynamical definition of entropy is actually really related to the information theoretic entropy. And this is surprising, for example, just for the reason, if you think about what does information theoretic entropy mean, then it was defined by Shannon to quantify how much you can compress information. What's the smallest number of bits you need to carry a certain, let's say, piece of information, let's say a movie that you want to encode. And that this information theoretic notion of compression has something to do with heat flowing is in some way a highly non-trivial observation. Of course, once one analyzes that, this all becomes quite clear. But I think this is an important conceptual step linking information theory and physics. Now one can also, once one understands that, go back, and I will, by the way, soon come to time, but I will spend the next 5 or 10 minutes still talking about just information theory and its relation to physics. One can then try to understand things that have been quite unclear before one had this relation. And one of these examples is Maxwell's demon. I guess you certainly have heard of it. I think any physicist has heard of it. at some point, probably quite early in their career. So the paradox, or the apparent paradox, consists essentially of the fact that it seems that if we could build a little agent that can open a trapdoor in such a way that only particles that come from the right pass through to the left, but no particle from the left passes through the right, to the right, then you would here produce a pressure difference. Actually, Maxwell's original example was about temperature difference, but you can also understand it in that way. And then you can exploit this pressure difference to generate work. So you would, the effect of that is that you would essentially convert heat, which is in the kinetic energy of these particles, into work. Now, actually, this was really a question that bothered me already when I was a child, and I had no idea of how I should understand this. And I was extremely relieved when I actually only after my studies finally read this work of Bennett and Landher and started to understand what goes wrong. And what goes wrong is not that you cannot build such a daemon. Actually, today's quantum technology allows us certainly to do that, maybe not exactly in this setting, but in some equivalent settings, maybe with trapped ions or superconducting qubits. But the problem is of a very different kind. The problem is that this agent, by opening and closing the door, has to have at least at some point some information about whether a particle comes here from the right or from the left. So each time he opens or closes, he has certainly the information whether he should open or close the door. And this information he has certainly at some point in his brain. And now he could just continue the process and accumulate this information about opening and closing. But each time it's a new piece of information, because let's say every fraction of a second, a new particle arises, and he gets this information, whether it's from left to right. So he would accumulate a lot of information about the particles in the box. And that process would be possible. So he could build a daemon that accumulates this information in his brain or wherever, in some storage device, and lets this process, and makes this process work. So the daemon could actually be built, and heat could apparently be converted into work. But the problem is that this is not a circular process, and therefore it's not contradicting the second law of thermodynamics. It's not a circular process because exactly of this fact that I mentioned before, the daemon will acquire knowledge. And this knowledge, this information, is physical. So it's somewhere there in some device, in his storage device or in his brain, if you like. And in order to make this a cyclic process, you have to erase that information again, or, as I said, a better word would be to reset that storage device. And that amount of work that you would have to invest then, according to the principle I showed before, would exactly compensate any gain you could get from running the steam. So this is just to illustrate that information is really very closely linked to physics, and we can learn a lot in conceptual understanding from thinking about information. This is, of course, not at all anything new. This is more to illustrate, let's say, the excitement we have in information theory about applying this to physics and why we think this is something that can help us understanding. But now you have seen this is already somehow a bit, the second example is something a bit going the other direction than Landauer had in mind. Landauer was saying information is physical. But now what I'm telling you is that by understanding information better, we can also learn something about physics. Someone could in some way promote an opposite slogan, a reverse slogan. It's not really the opposite, kind of a counterpart to Landauer's slogan, and say physics is informational. So if there is some physical object, there is always some information, or there should be some information link to it, and I will make this in a few slides a bit clearer. Now, as a second non-time example, and the last one to set the stage, I would like, or actually I will have a third one, but the third one will already go very close to time. I'll just mention that thinking really about information, also in a quantitative sense, not only in this, let's say, vague sense of someone has some information about something, can really help us sharpening certain statements about the foundations of physics. And I think one very nice example is the uncertainty principle. And you may have seen the entropic version of that. And it's called an entropic version. I would call it an information theoretic version because it says the following. You could ask yourself, let's suppose we have an agent, and this agent has some information about a physical system, let's say a spin particle. And this spin particle is going to be measured either in a measurement that distinguishes up or from down, or a measurement that distinguishes left from right. And I will call Z the outcome of the first measurement and X the one I mentioned second. But of course, only one measurement can be carried out. But even if only one measurement can be carried out, we can ask ourselves, how much does Alice know about the outcome? And what information theorists now would naturally do is to say, we quantify knowledge in terms of entropy, but information theoretic entropy. So they would write down quantities like this. I'm doing that now. For example, H of Z given A. What does this quantity mean? It means how uncertain is Alice, given this knowledge that is here indicated by this green piece of paper, about the outcome set of the result. And quantitatively, what it really means is that if you would repeat the experiment many times and you would ask yourself how much information, how many bits or how many yes-no questions do you need to answer to Alice, such that Alice at the end knows the value set for certain. So a priori she may have some knowledge, but then some partial knowledge, and then she asks you questions, is it that or is it that? And if she has an optimal strategy, there is a certain number or at least an expected number of yes, no questions you have to answer until she's able to say, ah, Z was that value. And H quantifies how many of these yes and no questions you have to answer per repetition of this experiment. And of course, you can do the same for X. This would be a quantity like this. And now what you can say, I think the elegance of the formula shows that this is probably a good approach, is to say, let's just see how much information he has in total about the two things. And what turns out to be the case is that this is just larger or equal to one. So this is an extremely nice formula, which just tells you that there's always at least one bit of uncertainty. You can kind of choose whether it's about this or about that, but it's always somewhere. Maybe it's somehow distributed. And this is, I should stress, a very different way of thinking about the uncertainty principle. It's a very different, at least quantitative way. Of course, you can also, you probably are familiar with the uncertainty principle in terms of variance and so on. But this is somehow a way which has proved to be also actually useful for applications. And one application is quantum cryptography, where exactly such relations can be used in modern security proofs to show security of quantum key distribution, for example. So you see this connection between information theory and physics is again helping us gaining some understanding. Now, for the rest, or for the, let's say, the time part of my talk and for everything that comes, it's maybe useful if I just tell you, I mean, many of you may already know that, but tell you what is kind of one of the favorite measures of information theorists. I mean, an information theorist, of course, talks about the information and wants to quantify it. And you have already seen this quantity of entropy. But there's somehow another measure which is immediately derived from entropy, which is called the mutual information. And it's usually denoted like this, I of, for example, S and A. So that I would call is the mutual information between S and A, and you could interpret it intuitively as how much information does this piece here, this green paper in this case, give you about this S, the spin system here in this picture. And the way this is defined is also in a very intuitive way. It's just defined as a difference between entropies. This is a very, let's say, commonly used definition. And you see what it tells you, what the right-hand side tells you is it's this H of S is how uncertain are you about the state of the system S. You can again think if you want about these yes-no questions. If you know nothing about S, how many yes-no questions would you need to answer to know S? This thing is, how much would you know about S if you already know what is written on this piece of paper? And now you see the mutual information. How much information does A give about S is really the difference. How much does the uncertainty decrease about S if you learn A? The reason why this measure is so important in information theory is that it has all intuitive properties you would expect from an information measure. I'll just give you one example. An example is that if you ask yourself, what happens if Alice somehow processes her information? She applies some function, little f, to her information. And what can we then say about how much does she now know about this? Now, an important property of information is that if you locally process it and don't gain anything new, you cannot at the end know more about S. Of course, you can forget things. The function could just throw away A and output the constant, in which case, of course, you have lost information, but it can never increase. And this is a fundamental inequality, which is called the data processing inequality. Okay, that will play a role for some of the intuition that I will give a little bit later in the talk. Now, one last thing I want to define, this is again the definition here written out. You can also consider more complex things. And one of these more complex things, it's not very much more complex, but it's actually very nice, is something we call the conditional mutual information. So conditional mutual information, for example, here, between S and B, conditioned on A, tells you how much does B tell you about S if you already know A. And the definition of this is, again, very intuitive. You just say, how much did you know about S if you already knew A? How much did you, or how uncertain are you about S if you knew A, minus how uncertain are you about S once you know A and B? So what's the difference in your uncertainty when you learn B? That's this thing, given that you already know A. And this is very intuitive. This thing also, again, satisfies this data processing inequality that I've described before. However, and this shows you maybe that this is all not so trivial as it may seem, proving this data processing inequality is highly non-trivial mathematically, at least in the quantum case, when all these systems are quantum systems. Okay, let me now give you come back to this kind of reverse slogan that I introduced at the beginning to motivate the whole approach. So the slogan I called is physics is informational. And I think, and to spell out what one could mean by that is the following. Suppose you have some quantity, let's call it lambda, and think of this as a quantity that you come up with in a physical theory. So you invent, you have some physical theory, quantum mechanics, or maybe something, let's say, call it now more exotic, Bohmian mechanics, and you have this lambda. And now you can ask yourself, does this lambda, what is the physical, or does it even have a physical meaning? And now from this slogan, a natural way to answer this question would be, a necessary condition for this to have physical meaning should be that we can, at least in principle, have information about it. So there should be some physical process. Maybe it doesn't have to be causal from here to here or in the other direction, but there must be some way, some physical way in principle, I stress that, not in practice necessarily, which produces some piece of information A in such a way that this A is at the end correlated to lambda. If this is not the case, then you have just, in a way, defined a purely mathematical quantity, something you cannot in principle access. I mean, that's just essentially spelling out what this could mean. I'm not saying this has to be like that, but that's essentially the approach I will follow in now also investigating, for example, the role of time. Because as I will show in a few minutes or propose, we can ask this question about different notions of time. Are these physical notions or not? So lambda would in this case, for example, be time as defined in quantum mechanics, the time parameter. And there's this question, is this time parameter physical or not? And maybe, of course, here I gave you a very simple kind of criterion. Of course, we can now make it quantitative. How physical is it? How much of it, how much of this value of this real time parameter is really physical, and what, to what extent is it just a mathematical nice definition that is convenient but is not really accessible, is not correlated to anything we can really access? That's now you hopefully see a bit in which direction I try to go. Now, one last sidestep before actually going into this question of time. I would like to give you an example which is related to some research I did some time ago with Roger Kolbeck, who, by the way, also spent quite some time at the PI some time ago. And I think during the time when we developed this result, he was actually partially at PI. This is a theorem which is about bell-type experiments. And I just want to give this as an illustration of how these quantities can be used. So essentially the purpose of this example is to tell you that all these definitions I've introduced are not just kind of for fun. Of course, they are fun. They have nice properties, but they can really be applied in a way in practice, at least in the practice of someone who does fundamental physics. Now, what did I do here? So I'm looking at the bell type setting where we have here, let's say, a measurement device, let's say on Alice's side. This is a measurement device on Bob's side. Let's suppose Alice and Bob are separated. That's usually in a bell type experiment. There's maybe a common source, for example, of entangled state, of entangled pairs, bell pairs, for example, to entangled photons. And there's also an input to this measurement device, which tells you how you want to measure. And this X is the output of the measurement. Now I'm deviating a bit from the Bell setup and assume that in this alpha is an arbitrary measurement. So it just is a description of how you want to measure the system that comes in. And suppose that this is, for example, a spin particle coming in here on both sides from this source. And you can now choose to measure it in an arbitrary direction. Now there's a theorem which tells you the following. Oh, maybe I should first say, why did I here write the lambda and the psi? So of course, psi stands for the quantum mechanical wave function. So if we model this whole Bell experiment with an ordinary quantum theory, and I tell you what is the initial state of the source here that generates the particles, the spins that go to Alice and Bob, then I can calculate a probability distribution for the outcomes if I know here the measurements that were chosen. But now suppose that we have some, let's say, more advanced theory that does not only contain the quantum state, but something in addition. So here, again, you could think of Bohmian mechanics and lambda could be whatever the hidden variables are. Now, the question one could ask is this additional thing physical or not? Now, the statement one can make is the following, and this will actually, this first condition will exclude now Bohmian mechanics. So Bohmian mechanics is just an example of what the lambda could be, but the first condition is essentially a condition that information theoretically speaking tells you the following. If you now read this and compare it to what I, to the definition of this, this tells you how much information does the outcome here, Y, give you about alpha, about the measurement choice made by Alice, if you know the whole source state here and you also know how this Y was measured. And this is kind of the converse thing. It tells you how much does this X, the outcome of Alice, tell you about Bob's input, conditioned on that you know how the X was measured. So you know this alpha and you also know the source state. And now I could make an assumption, which is usually called a non-signaling assumption, where I say this should be zero. And as I said before, in Bohmian mechanics, that would not be fulfilled, by the way. But you can now think of a theory where this is fulfilled, but that has an additional parameter, lambda, potentially. And now the theorem, which is an information theoretic theorem, as you see here in a way, tells you that in this case, if there is this non-signaling condition or there's no information condition between alpha and y vice versa, beta and x is fulfilled, then this lambda will actually not give you any information about the outcome here. The same could be said, by the way, about the outcome here. which is not only already contained in Psi. So if this is the, how much information does Lambda give you about X, if you already know Psi, and you of course also should know how X was measured. So this is just to illustrate the way information theorists think about these type of problems. And what this tells you now in general terms is that if you have a physical theory that is local in that sense, or that is non-signaling, I should say, then you cannot extend quantum theory. Quantum theory is informationally complete. Whatever you add to it, whatever lambda you add to it, you will not gain any additional information about measurement outcomes. And this is in a way a strengthening of Bell's theorem. And this is just for those who are experts, and I know there are many experts on that at PI. Bell's theorem just tells you there is no deterministic thing. And of course, there were extensions of Bell's theorem, but this is essentially the most extended version in the sense that it tells you that any hidden or any additional parameter would really give you zero information about these outcomes. Okay, so I hope I convinced you that information theoretic measures are really useful to phrase statements on the foundations. And let's now come to time finally. So what I told you before kind of motivates a research program, which I think I'm not the only one following, but I'm certainly very enthusiastic about this program. And the research program is to now study the notion of time. And time can, of course, mean very different things. I mean, this is obvious, like when you in particular listen to these talks in the workshop, time is kind of an overarching, let's say, term that stands for many different concepts, many different aspects that time actually has. Nonetheless, we can ask the question, if we have a particular notion of time, for example, the notion of time, the time parameter in quantum mechanics, or maybe some notion of time as in GR. I mean, these are of course different notions, but if you take one of them, we can ask ourselves, how physical is this notion of time? Now, exactly in this sense of, can we have information about it? So I drew here a clock because typically the devices that would actually give us information about time are something like clocks. And now, okay, maybe I should make this a bit smaller. You see here, the question could be phrased like that in the terms that I've introduced. We could ask ourselves, if you take a theory, for example, quantum theory, and put here the theoretical time, the time as it is phrased within that theory, and on the right-hand side, we put an actually observable quantity, like something we can read from clocks, maybe also according to that theory, but it should now be something where we know this relates to an in principle experimentally accessible value. Is this mutual information between the two zero, positive, or even large? That's the type of question. And this question, the answer to that question will, of course, very much depend on what I put here, but it's kind of a test bed to compare different notions of time. We can put here whatever we like, whatever time is in quantum theory, in another theory, and see how this behaves. Now, I will now from now on just focus on the case of quantum theory. So I will essentially go to, in a way, Pauli's question, because you could say, Pauli's famous statement or proof that there is no time observable can now be phrased in information theoretic terms. As you probably know, there is a huge debate about what this proof exactly proves, what it really means, what are precisely the conditions. Now, when I rephrase this in information theoretic terms, I somehow circumvent that debate a little bit because the question, I don't want to claim it's really the same question, it's somehow a very closely related question. And the very closely related question is the one I posed before. If you think of the time here, like the one appearing in Schrödinger's equation, how much information can an actual physical system, like a clock, give us about this time? And that should then tell us something about the nature of this T. So I guess tomorrow there will be a talk by Nicolas Gisard about, I think, intuitionistic mathematics. Maybe I misspelled this word, but I think in these talks that I've seen in the past, he was usually making the claim that if you take a time parameter that is real, or any parameter in physics that is real, real according to mathematics, a real number, then this should not be seen as a real physical quantity. So in that sense, real is a bad term. It's not something that is physical. And he has various arguments to make that point. And you could now kind of understand what I'm saying here as a different approach to somehow make the same claim, to say that this is a real value, but if you don't really have infinite information about it, which you would need to determine the real value, then this real number is somehow not really a physical number. Not all the digits have a physical meaning in some sense, or it's quantized. That's another way to say it in a vague sense, but information theory will make this a bit more precise. And that's, of course, in the spirit of this workshop about quantizing time. So you could also ask yourself, so if this information that this thing gives you about t is finite, then necessarily this is, in at least in this information theoretic sense, a quantized quantity. By the way, today listening to the very nice talk of Lorenzo Marconi also reminded me of this question, because I think one could also take these approaches where we see, when we look at the Wheeler-DeWitt equation or like a static view on measurements of time, we could ask this same question. What do the measurements he considers, for example, in his construction on time, what does this mean in this context? I don't immediately have an answer, but it would be interesting to actually apply these information theoretic concepts to the view that he presented. Okay, now this is just a definition that I make, which should probably be now, after all I've said, be very intuitive. I could somehow ask myself, if I have a physical system like a clock, but this definition applies to any physical system, I could somehow quantify the maximum information content of that system. And the way I do that is just I correlate something else, this A here, to this physical system, and I ask myself, what's the maximum mutual information that I can essentially build up between this physical system and A? And that quantity may depend on various parameters. In principle, I could have some, for example, finite dimension here that constrains this, or a finite energy or whatever. But usually that's a finite quantity for any realistic system. Now, before moving on, I want kind of to make the point that instead of now answering directly this question about how much information does a clock give us about time, we could also somehow ask ourselves, how much information does a clock give us about another clock? And that will certainly bound somehow how much information it will give us about time. So the way this bound works has actually, this can even be made very precise, again, using these mutual information measures, because the mutual information measures have various mathematical properties that allow you, for example, to estimate the correlation here from other correlations in other directions. I'm not going into that, but it has to do with chain rules and, again, the data processing inequality. So all I want to say here, or which is important for the following, is that I could also ask this question, how much information does this clock give me about that clock? Let's just focus at the moment on this question. Is there a bound on that? Now, I haven't really said so far what is time, and by rephrasing this, I mean, I said it's the quantum mechanical time, but by rephrasing this a bit, I even have less, it's becoming less urgent to really say what I consider time, because I'm just considering essentially whatever the clock shows. And what I mean by what the clock shows is really like the output of a clock. So you take a device and you look what it produces, and a simple thing that a clock could do is to somehow define events in time. And this again, by the way, reminds me of something important of or has an important relation to what Lorenzo Marconi said in his talk. He said that there is this important conceptual, let's say, mismatch between general relativity or not only general relativity, even special relativity and quantum mechanics, in the sense that the basic objects in relativity theory are events, which are points in space-time. Whereas when we talk about quantum theory, events, at least in that sense, as points in space-time, are not fundamental. They don't appear. But now if you talk about time, and I want to draw diagrams like this, then of course events are defined just by essentially the output of a clock. If I have a clock and it kind of outputs, let's suppose the clock kind of ticks, if you like. The clock tells me now I've produced this event, now it's 3 o'clock, now it's 4 o'clock, now it's 5 o'clock, now it's 6 o'clock. Then I have actual events. And I will come back to this question again. This will be important. What are these events precisely? But just think of them as events somehow defined by the clock. Now, if two clocks were perfect, I would certainly satisfy the condition that the clocks could produce a kind of chronological order of this type. So I could set up the clock such that, for example, the A clock ticks, then the B clock ticks, then the A clock ticks for the second time, the B clock ticks for the second time, and so on. And if they were perfect, this chronological order would just hold forever. This, I'm saying this because I could also use that as a very natural and operational, by the way, measure essentially quantify the accuracy of a clock, and this measure will also play a role in what I'm going to say. I could somehow say, let's take the, for example, average, so this is in quotation mark because that would be a random variable itself, but let's say the average ticks until this perfect synchronization between the clock fails. So until, for example, this happens, what you see here, namely that the green clock ticked twice in between two ticks of the orange clock. So that would be a failure. And so in this case, the R would be something like 5 or 4, depending on whether I define it here based on the green or the orange one. Now, by the way, I should make a remark. I'm not in what I'm doing in any way trying to claim that clocks are kind of the fundamental thing that we should consider. So I think this is important because I very much sympathize with those who are saying that clocks were never there originally when the universe was created. And so clocks will not be necessary to define time. So here clocks are more a tool for me, a conceptual tool to understand in this sense, in this slogan sense I said before, whether in principle we can have information about the physical quantity. Okay, this was just a remark. Actually, I made this remark because I was recently watching a talk recorded by Achim Kempf, who I think made this point very clearly that it's not, I mean, the operational approach is interesting, but one shouldn't really claim that sticks and rods and clocks are fundamental. And this is just to say that I share this view, but it's not in contradiction to what I'm saying. Okay, now let's take an example of a clock. And a naive example of a clock could be something very small. I mean, you could say a spin that just rotates is somehow already a perfect clock if this spin is completely isolated from noise sources and so on. So what I mean by that is I could set up the clock by putting the spin in, let's say, the up direction. And let's suppose the spin has somehow two energy levels arranged in such a way that this spin will rotate at the fixed frequency, which of course depends on the difference between the two energy levels. And then I could say I define the event, what I called tick before, as the fact that the spin is up. So the clock starts here in up, it will rotate, somewhere it's down, I mean, it will be somewhere in between. And at some point it will again be up. And then I say, this is the second event, then it will rotate further, and then there's a third event. So these would be what I called before the ticks. So I could here say that's the tick one, that's the tick two, that's the tick three. And similarly for the other clock. And this would remain perfect. So in a perfect scenario, and with these only two-dimensional clocks, I would have, if I don't have noise, a clock where this R value that I defined before would go to infinity, because there's no reason why they should get out of synchronization. This is now really opposing, or this is causing a lot of headache to any information theorist, at least certainly to me, because what it suggests is that there's somehow an infinite amount of information in these ticks about the other ticks. Because if I, for example, know that this second tick happened, let's say I'm Alice and I'm here and the second tick happened, but not yet the third, then I know perfectly that the second tick of the Bob clock will happen somewhere in between. But this is true for infinitely long. And so at least, I mean, this was now not a mathematical statement, but at least in this intuitive level, it's clear that this somehow contains an infinite amount of information that Alice has about the time as measured by Bob. Now, to make this precise is a bit more tricky, because one would have to ask oneself, what is actually the probability distribution over these ticks in order to even apply these measures? That's why you should understand this more as a, let's say, intuition that I want to give. But why is this now really causing headache to me? I told you before about the data processing inequality, and the data processing inequality tells you that if you have some mutual information between, for example, two systems, let's suppose we look at the mutual information between the clock A and the clock B, then this mutual information can never increase unless there is additional information coming in. So if these clocks would communicate with each other, they could somehow increase their mutual information. But if they don't, if they just both silently move along their world lines, this mutual information can only decrease. And whatever they produce, so whenever they process their own information, which happens if they, so the tick is something, you could understand the tick as something derived from the clock, like a function of the clock. The mutual information between these time information should therefore be bounded by the mutual information that I have initially between the two clocks. And because the clocks are two-dimensional systems, qubits in this sense, it will be bounded by two. So actually, that's just a general information theoretic statement that the mutual information is always bounded by twice the logarithm of the dimension of any of the two systems. And now you see this seems to violate the data processing inequality. So I initially have this amount of information between the clocks, but somehow they seem to produce more information, time information somehow, namely an infinite amount. And that certainly shouldn't be the case according to any reasonable information theoretic theory. Now, as I said, I was a bit vague, and indeed the vagueness led to a mistake. And let's see, what is the mistake in this consideration? The mistake is the following. It has again to do with this notion of events that I mentioned before. So the question is, what is really fundamentally in an event? Here, I just defined the event to be like a situation where the spin points up. Like, and this, of course, there are many such events on this line. So it's often the case that the spin points up. But now remember the slogan that I had. I said, something is only physical if I can have information about it. Now, I can fundamentally not have information about whether the spin is really up. I mean, I can calculate it on a piece of paper, but that's not information in that sense. That's just an abstract mathematical quantity. So I can calculate that the spin is up at this point, but I cannot know it unless I actually measure it or do something here. So it's actually questionable whether the event that I defined by saying the spin is up is a physical event. It certainly is not if I take this statement that I called physics is informational. If I take this serious, then it's not, because I cannot have information about this event. Okay, so let's try to correct for this. Let's say, let's make this a real event. And to make this a real event, I need to somehow make sure that there is really, in principle, accessible information about the fact that the spin was up, for example. Or more generally speaking, if I have a clock that, like this spin, evolves as a closed system, then I can never know anything about the clock. So what's inside is kind of, in that sense, not physical. It's only becoming physical when the clock emits some information about its internal state. So in that sense, the, a physical event, according to this slogan, is one where the clock actually emitted some information and said, actually now the pointer was showing 12 o'clock. And that's, of course, what real clocks do. At least, I mean, I'm now not talking about stopwatches where I take actively an action to see the time. I'm talking about clocks that just show the time. For example, a church clock, it just rings the bells when an hour has passed. And so it clearly emits information to the outside. And this ringing of the bell is now clearly an event in the physical sense, because I can have in principle information about it. Okay, but let's now take this as a this idea serious, that the event that's need to be produced by the clock. What we then see is that quantum mechanics gives immediately a constraint, because we know from quantum information theory again that there is a so-called information disturbance trade-off. The more information the clock emits, the more its internal state will be disturbed. So if you think of the spin clock, after it emitted somehow the information by some mechanism that its spin was up, the spin will no longer evolve, continue to evolve in an undisturbed way. And this is also true for a larger clock, as long as it's finite. So there will be this idea that the time information has to be physical, immediately leads to the fact that clocks cannot be precise. Okay, now I'm immediately, because time is running fast, and also I don't want to give you technical proofs, I immediately now come to one of our main results that we actually developed over the past few years, and it actually really took a few years to do it. I should also say it took me to get hold of a few very clever people. See here, Misha Woods, Ralph Silva, and Yushang Yang, who actually really did all this technical work. And what they were able to show and is essentially the following result. And this is a quite informal version. And there are many, let's say, additional things one has to say to make this precise, but roughly it tells you the following. This R thing, this is the number of ticks you can stay synchronized, which before was infinity. Remember, this was my concern, this was infinity, is actually, if we now take this idea of having physical ticks series bounded by an information theoretic quantity, namely the one I introduced, the maximum information one can have about the clock. So in other words, if I ask how long can a clock A stay synchronized, let's say with a copy of itself, with a similar clock, then the answer, the information theoretic answer is that the number of ticks it can emit, or the logarithm, is always bounded by the amount of information we can potentially have about its state. And I think this result really shows, like in this entropic uncertainty principles, that information theory is in a very natural way related to other quantities, like this clearly physically relevant quantity of how accurate we can measure time. So this result was proved, as I said, by Yushang Yang, and it's also tight. And the tightness was actually proved earlier by Misha Woods, Ralph Silva, and Jonathan Oppenheim by an explicit construction. So in that sense, you could even say that there's an equality for an optimal clock. As I said, there are some sub-reading terms one has to consider and things like that, but that's roughly the statement. And this statement is for me a very promising statement, because it tells me, or at least it suggests to me, that information theory can really give answers. And in this case, this is really an answer somehow to Pauli's question, because you could now say, this tells you in a quantitative way how much we can know about the physical time parameter, or the mathematical time parameter T. So as I said before, the mutual the synchronization of clock is also, of course, the synchronization with T, with the time parameter. So the amount of information we can have about the real parameter that appears in the quantum mechanical Schrödinger equation is bounded by this information theoretic quantity. So in particular, it's finite for any realistic system. So this is now another way of stating the, or making the statement that no physical system can measure time to an arbitrary precision. Okay, so the last thing I want to say is that this is now also of interest if you apply to the more general question of how well can we map out space-time. And this is again related to the question or the what then Lorenzo Marconi said, this question, are events actually fundamental, events as in relativity theory and quantum theory? I cannot answer that question, but what you can say is the following, that quantum theory gives us a bound. So if you take quantum theory as the fundamental thing, then what this result implies is that there is a fundamental bound on how fine-grained can the causal order see of events. Can the causal order between events that we can produce maximally be? And of course, now one has to take in certain parts of relativity. We have to take into account that this quantity, I max, as I said before, is actually bounded by the log of the dimension. Actually, there's a factor two that I forgot. And now relativity tells us that the logarithm of the dimension of the system is also related to the area of the system, because if that area is too small, it would form a black hole. So we cannot put an arbitrary amount of entropy into a very small system. And so taking all this together gives you at least, I mean, on an informal level, roughly the statement that there's no more fine-grained way of getting causal order then essentially, or on the Planck scale, you will lose the way quantum mechanics implies that on the Planck scale, you can no longer define a chronological order. This is, of course, nothing surprising, but it's just, in a way, you could see it as an information theoretic derivation of that statement that has been made, of course, in many other contexts. So to conclude this example, information theory allows us to make really fundamental statements about physics, in this case, about the maximal fine graining of chronological order in space-time. And I think this is really, for me, just the start of a promising program. And I'm currently working with many of these people I mentioned before on kind of continuing this and trying to see what we can really learn from this information theoretic approach. And finally, I just want to actually thank these very clever people who helped me making this progress and who are, many of them are still working on this. I mentioned before, Ralph Silva, Zhang Yang and Misha Woods, whom you know from today, and he was a session chair in today's conference session. Gilles Pütz and Leonard Baumgartner were students at the time we worked on this. Yang Chun Liang is now a professor, and Sandra Stupar was a PhD student at the time when we developed this. Okay, and with that, I would also like to thank the audience for the attention. It was a pleasure to have you, and I'm looking forward to questions.
Thank you very much, Renato. This was a really interesting talk. And So now we can open to questions from students. So just raise your hand and, well, your virtual hand. Okay, I see a question. Okay, Maddy, you're not a student, but since students are not asking questions, please go ahead.
Okay.
We open to questions from everybody in the audience.
Hi, Renato. Thank you for the great talk. I was just wondering the limit that you can put on the timekeeping, and that you quantify the thing by.
Mm-hmm. You mean this?
Locked. Yeah, exactly. Have you thought about how this might get modified if there is some kind of, let's say, energy conservation in the system?
Yes, this is a good question. So actually, my let's say, answer would be that any constraints you have on the system would somehow have to enter the right-hand side of this. So you could say this, remember this maximal Imax was defined as the maximum correlation you can build up with a system. So this was this definition here, I think. So you just take the system and try to correlate something with it, and you look what's the maximum correlation. Now this will, if you have an energy constraint here, then this will also immediately bound this mutual information, because it will bound the number of possible states you have here and therefore impose a bound on the mutual information. Having said this, you can even, I mean, this was not now the purpose of this talk, but you could also regard this as a kind of practical bound. You could ask yourself, if you have a real quantum system, for example, something that you manufacture with quantum technology, then of course this thing has many dimensions, but most of the dimensions are not accessible to you. You cannot control them. So for example, if you have a quantum computer, is the whole fridge around it, and you can ask what counts really as that. This measure gives you a very precise answer to that. It tells you whatever you can deliberately couple to it. If you somehow act on the system and try to maximize correlation with it, of course, you can now not act, for example, with the keyboard of your quantum computer. I mean, you can, but you cannot correlate things with it, but you can correlate things with the really internal degree of freedom. So this also gives you really a somehow practical measure of how good is the device potentially to measure time. And so this is just to tell you, it's not only energy conditions that would enter here, but there could be any also practical condition that would limit that.
Thank you.
Thanks, Rob.
Hi, Renato, thanks for a really nice talk. I wanted to ask about, you set up a situation where you know, a kind of plausibility argument for why the mutual information between the ticks of clock A and the ticks of clock B should go to infinity. And then you tried to explain why that intuition was wrong. Could you go back to that slide? Were you? Mm-hmm.
Yes, sure. This was the slide.
Yeah. So I want to offer a sort of different explanation of why that intuition is mm-hmm. wrong. And then maybe you can tell me whether you agree or whether you think it's the wrong explanation. And it's just that these are clocks, not calendars. They don't have degrees of freedom that can keep track of how many ticks have gone by. That, you know, like a calendar can keep track, but you know, a clock is modulo 12, and these are basically binary clocks. All they do is mm-hmm. zero or one. So the only thing I could hope to do by looking at the first clock is learn whether the second clock is in its zero or its one state. And if they're synchronized, I'll be able to infer that. And if they become desynchronized, I might not. But that's just the difference between having sort of one bit of information or zero bits of information about the other clock. But the only way you could ever have infinite is if these were more like calendars, and then the dimension of their Hilbert spaces, of course, would have to be infinitely large if you wanted to encode how many ticks have gone by mm-hmm. over an infinite amount of time. Yes.
Okay, yeah, that's a very good point. And I mean, I should say that one is a little bit on a kind of difficult terra here when I talk about information in time anyway. So this is just as a kind of disclaimer, because of the well-known problem, maybe for you it's not a problem, because I think maybe your frameworks may resolve exactly that problem. But let's say standard quantum theories usually or quantum information theories usually based on talking about a state which we imagine to be a state at the fixed time. And then when we talk about the state at the fixed time, I can somehow not even make sense of saying what's, for example, the probability that now it's time so and so. I mean, what's the probability that it's now 22 o'clock or so? I mean, that's not defined. So what I want to say with that is we don't have a good way of ascribing probabilities over time, and in particular not to put the quantum state that spans over time. Of course, there are ways to do that. And actually, my hope would be that time agnostic frameworks like you have them would allow us to do that. But now I think the answer to your question is in this case, if I understand it correctly, a different one. Let's suppose Here would be an observer, Alice, who would go with the clock. And let's suppose Alice has actually an infinite memory. So she would take the clock and just whenever there's a tick coming out of the finite clock, she would somehow say, okay, now it's the first tick and now it's the second and so on. But still, what happens then on this side is a local processing of information because there's just the clock and Alice. And this relation that I've shown at the beginning, this one, is actually even true if this F has an infinite output. So you could somehow do a processing on A, which is not maybe a deterministic function, but some completely positive map or even a sequence of completely positive maps or some physical process where you somehow start to fill up a very large register. This data processing inequality is still true. So it's not constrained on assuming that. So it only kind of starts with this. So the clocks are kind of, if I go back here, maybe and I try to apply this, I would say there is, let's say there's the clock A, and let's suppose Alice has a register. Let's call it somehow register of Alice. And of course, the register will be filled by interaction with the clock. I mean, that's the only thing Alice can do. And now the data processing inequality tells you that if I now look at the, for example, the mutual information between this infinite dimensional register of Alice and maybe still what remains in the clock, and maybe the same on Bob's side, this should still be bounded by the initial correlation I had. So in other words, even if I put infinite systems, of course, they should not be a priori already correlated. So the assumption I made here implicitly is that this register RA that Alice has and RB, they can be infinite dimensional, but before they start, they are uncorrelated. The only correlation is in the clock. Then we still have this problem in some way. But as I said, this is not a mathematically precise statement, because what I'm doing here is confusing a bit statements about states at the fixed time and still talking about stuff that is generated over time. So that's not, I'm not claiming that this is clean. That was more for the intuition. But this is why I think what you said is not immediately telling us that the problem lies in the finiteness of the clock, because I could still allow an infinite register on Alice and Bob's side.
Okay, well, I still have more questions about that, but maybe I can ask you later and we can move
on. Sure, yes. Yes, of course, yes.
Thanks.
Okay, the next question is from Max.
Hi, Renato. Thanks for a nice talk. I don't know if you have any more to say about this than you already said to Rob's question, but I'm going to ask just in case. So before you started talking about comparing two clocks, you had some kind of notion. You had this small lowercase t, and we're talking about the relationship between a clock and this t.
Yes, I think this was here, yes.
Yeah, well, or one back.
Yes, but, even yeah. Here or so, yes.
Yes, that's it. And so I like this idea of trying to quantify this, but the way that I understand of doing this is the way that was done a long time ago now, where one thinks of t as a sort of parameter that takes a definite value and then asks about a parameter estimation problem, and then this whole what's this called, Fisher information procedure, but. So when you write down this mutual information, I find it very hard to understand that, because the t in the Schrodinger equation is a parameter. It should take a fixed value somehow, whereas the mutual information is defined between two probability distributions. So how am I supposed to understand that?
Yeah. You're really pointing the finger at something which is very difficult to deal with, and I'm not sure we have here really the ultimate answer. So this is something that is still on the development. So maybe I should say this result that I've shown at the end, this is really precise and mathematically rigorous, whereas the part about t, so maybe remember this result didn't talk about this small t. This was more to give you intuition. So what I would say is what we are I mean, there are various ways to think about it, but you would always need to somehow, if you want to use information theory, you need to assign probabilities to these T. But this is also happening when you look at the static state. I mean, when you look at kind of the universe as a non-evolving system, I mean, there are these approaches, of course, we have heard of them today, for example, in the conference, where you somehow put the probability distribution on T, which is maybe not a normalized one, but you need to somehow have a measure over T. So the answer is essentially you need to have some construction. So if you really want to directly give meaning to the mutual information as an information measure between T and this TA, you need to somehow assign a probability measure to T, for example, the uniform one, or you can, for example, bound it. And like, I mean, you have these divergence problems, but you can just bound it and say, let's suppose it's between some fixed initial and final time, and then we are uniform, and then do the calculations, and then let the boundaries go to infinity. But this all gets very messy, and because of that, I was kind of deviating to this and say, let's study that, because that's a much more well-defined problem. But we can then still, using these, I mean, now assuming that we can somehow make sense of this and assign probabilities, we can still, from the mutual information between these two, in certain Markov type assumptions that, for example, the information here, I mean, that essentially this is a Markov chain and like this, I mean, that, and that we can then infer statements about this. But essentially your question, the reason why you asked, or the problem underlying this that you point at, is really the reason why for the technical statements, we are actually talking about this scenario.
Okay, right. And then,
much
then,
more well defined.
And then in those technical statements, you don't assume a probability distribution over small t. Then are you taking some kind
No, because then essentially t generates these. So t is only needed essentially to generate these random variables.
And
so,
right.
Of course, you have to make certain assumptions. For example, we have to assume, or it's natural to assume, that, I mean, you need a certain model, so to speak, how T generates this time information. And there's actually an interesting recent paper by Misha Woods about the model that was used and discusses it on an axiomatic grounds, where we say, what do we require from such system that kind of tell us something about time? And you, for example, want to assume that they are not themselves getting external help. So you look at processes that are autonomous and so on. And this is discussed in this paper. So if you are interested in kind of a justification, which I didn't really mention the model, but if you are interested in that model, I think this is a nice source to get some insight into that.
Okay, thanks.
Into what you're asking.
Okay, Namrata.
Hi, thank you for the wonderful talk. I'm just trying to understand this. If we say that information is physical, then could you talk a little bit about perhaps conservation of information in a closed system? Since we can see that the information could decay within a clock. You mentioned that earlier. So would that still mean, I know earlier someone asked about conservation of energy with this, but like, as long as it's a closed system, do you think it'll be conserved since it's a physical?
Yes. Problem? Yeah, this is a question that is very difficult to answer for me, because maybe I made it clear that this is really a kind of a research program that has just started. And these are questions that I don't have a good answer to. And I should say that maybe I want to make a relation to something else rather than answering the question. So there are recent frameworks by, for example, Lucia Hardy, Rob Speckens, and Peter Oeckel, that try to kind of phrase quantum theory into a framework or into a formalism that is kind of time, I call it time agnostic in some way. I'm not sure this really gives justice to what they're doing, but that's one aspect of them, that you're not, for example, a priori having, let's say, a clear time arrow in them. And of course, these frameworks do additional things, which are also important, for example, to separate the chronological order from the order in which we make inferences. Now, the reason why your question is so hard to answer is that what we are doing in quantum information, if you are using the standard tools, is really to mix up the two notions. And this causes problems exactly in this research program. That's why I have a lot of hope in these new frameworks and try to understand them. And so to be a bit more precise, if, for example, in quantum information, so we model, I mean, a basic object is what we call a trace preserving completely positive map. This is just, in some way, we usually say this is the most general thing that can happen to a system. But in some way, it's not the most general thing. It's already assuming that we have an initial state and then there is something happening, some evolution, and then we have a final state. But now when we talk about, I mean, okay, this is unproblematic when we have applications, when we say, okay, we have an initial state and then something happens and we're asking what's the final state, what's, for example, happening when we are putting something into a communication channel and what comes out. But now we are somehow really, or in these usual applications, the time is really not usually playing a role. It's not even modeled. We are just assuming there is a time order and the input is there before the output. And it's usually we want to infer the output from the input and so on. But now we want to explicitly have an information theory that takes into account time. And now we have to rethink these notions like completely positive maps. Do they really now model an evolution in time, or do they model just inference that we know some part and then something else? And as I said, the current formalism, I think, is not suitable because it just mixes the things up. So I think to really have a good answer to your question, one needs these better frameworks that are not putting so many implicit assumptions about time into the thing. So maybe the short answer is current quantum information theory and the tools we have are putting lots of assumptions about time already into the formalism. For example, the very definition of completely positive maps has a lot of this already into it. I mean, you can see that already from the fact that it's not time asymmetric, whereas there is,
right.
If you look at, for example, Rob's or Lucia's frameworks, or also Oeckel's framework, it's not, I mean, it's, and there are many others, so I'm just mentioning a few of them. There's no reason why there should be an arrow of time in the formalism of quantum theory. It's just something we built into it. And I think the future of this research program will be to kind of apply more general techniques, and then we can hopefully answer these questions. So I'm sorry for not answering it, but no. I think it's an interesting program.
At least I'm asking the right
questions. I hope to have answers in a few years from now.
Right, thank you.
Arshit? I don't know if you're speaking, but we cannot hear you. We still cannot hear.
I can also not see him.
Yeah.
Can you hear me now?
Yes.
Yeah. So you were talking about two clocks, and we wanted to know if these two clocks are synchronous. But I mean, not synchronous, but if clock A ticks before, if the nth tick of clock A is before nth tick of clock B forever for all the values of n. So can we relate this in some way to Maxwell's Riemann? I mean, to know whether an tick of clock A is before an tick of clock B, we'll have to wait for all the ticks. So in some way, we are gaining some information and then erasing it.
Mm-hmm. Okay, I'm not sure I understood everything completely because there was some kind of transmission problem, but I think you mentioned the relation, or you asked about the relation to Maxwell's Riemann somehow. Is this correct?
Yeah.
Yes. So actually, this is an extremely good question. And there has been some work done on understanding the thermodynamic properties of such clocks. There was some work by Erker and others, and also Ralph Silva and Misha Woods, whom you saw on my last slide, are involved in that. And I think Jonathan Oppenheim, if I remember correctly. So here, the question was, I mean, it has to do with this thing that I mentioned here, that a clock, in order to really produce ticks, has to somehow interact with its outside. And so as soon as you have an interaction of the clock with the outside, you're producing entropy, you could say. I mean, from the outside viewpoint, there's now, I mean, of course, if this was a closed system, there is no entropic change around the clock. But if the clock outputs stuff, then this has an impact on the entropy of the surrounding. And of course, as soon as entropy changes, you could ask yourself, is there a thermodynamic cost to the operation of such a clock? And the answer is yes, there is a thermodynamic cost to a clock. And in that sense, there is really a relation to Landauer's principle, because Landauer's principle also tells you that if there is an information theoretic entropy change, then there must be some thermodynamic cost. And so in that sense, I think the answer is yes, it's very closely related. I was here not talking about this. I was kind of ignoring the thermodynamic aspect of this, but you can equally well kind of put thermodynamic bounds on clocks. But and this is really interesting, because my, let's say, conjecture would be that these thermodynamic bounds would actually probably be the same bounds as these type of bounds here, because these bounds, as I said, are coming from this information disturbance trade-off, but you can also relate this information disturbance trade-off again to Maxwell's demon. They're both related to information theoretic quantities. So maybe another way to understand this is that to say that this clock is a thermodynamic object is just another way to say that the clock produces entropy. But if there is an entropy production to the outside, there must be a disturbance inside, because entropy to the outside means there is some, probably some correlation between the inside and the outside, because the overall, let's suppose, the overall state remains pure. So an entropy production here results in a change here and causes a disturbance. So it could well be that analyzing this from a more thermodynamic perspective, you get the very same bounds, because this information theoretic perspective or this thermodynamic perspective via Landauer's principle is maybe just this information theoretic one in other terms. But that's just a conjecture. That would be an interesting question to study.
Yeah, okay. Thank you.
Okay, do we have more questions?
Can I ask? I'd like to ask about your the thing you presented in the beginning when you said quantum mechanics was informationally complete, and you had this signaling in the Bell scenario.
Mm-hmm.
And the question is, why do you include the hidden parameter, presumably hidden parameter lambda, in your definition of what you call no signaling? And does it have something to do with the assumptions about the directions of time? And the reason I'm asking this is because I'm going to present on Friday a toy model, which I would say has no signaling, but according to your definition, it wouldn't. So I'm a bit confused about it.
Okay. Yeah, I'm not sure I can answer the second question, what it has to do with the arrow of time, but I can certainly answer this first question, why this is included here. So, I mean, the reason is the following. If you have, if you would just consider quantum theory alone, and there is, of course, no lambda, then obviously you would just phrase this condition without the lambda, and in this case, it's always satisfied. By the way, this just follows from the fact that if you have a local operation here, then it doesn't do anything here according to quantum theory. Now, what I mean when I say non-signaling, then it's really non-signaling within the extended theory. So I just assume someone comes up with a new theory. And this new theory has now let's say, this parameter. Maybe it still has psi as well. And now I'm just asking, in this new theory, this is now really a statement about this new theory, do we have signaling in that sense? Now, signaling is in this sense maybe not, okay, actually I feel a bit, I'm always a bit uncertain about these terms, because I know that there are now probably people in the audience who have developed much more fine grained terms to express all this. So if you say signaling is really an operational thing that we can do without accessing lambda, then it's not signaling in that sense. So it's maybe one should really call it the locality assumption, in the sense of saying this, the theory is local. But the point is that, let's say, the operational meaning of this is the following. If you had access to these parameters of the theory, so someone who has access to these parameters could, if this was not zero, signal by choosing an alpha here and observing the output here. So if there is Alice here and Bob is here, and you ask yourself, what can they do if under the condition that they actually have access to them? And this is, of course, an important condition. What I'm saying is only through them. Then if this was not zero, this means they can signal, because what this thing now tells you is that if you change alpha a little bit, then the y has to change, or the y has to take a different value. Otherwise, this would be zero if they were independent. So in other words, the non-signaling really refers to a situation where you have access to these two quantities.
But it also seems to refer to a situation where you can fix lambda. You can sort of think of lambda as not being dependent on alpha.
Okay, later you choose. Okay, the question is also what fixing means. So this here just assumes that you lambda is somehow known. Whether you chose it or not is irrelevant. But indeed, an assumption that I didn't mention here. So this is is that alpha is some value you can choose. So indeed, if lambda, okay, maybe that is something I should have said now. So in a superdeterministic theory, for example, where you could say there's no way you can choose alpha, this quantity would not make much sense. So I was kind of implicitly making it here by saying this alpha has no incoming arrow. So that was for me just a kind of diagrammatic way to say that this alpha is something you can choose independently of the lambda. But maybe I should have stated it here, that this theorem, in addition to that, requires, I think I said that you can choose any possible measurement of doing this. And it's indeed important that you can do any possible measurement. I think I said it's not only the Bell measurement. So you should be able, whatever lambda is, you should be able to choose this, how to measure this system here, this incoming spin, in whatever basis. So that's kind of the experimental assumption that is implicit to this plot here.
Yeah, in order to continue this discussion, we would have to actually talk about what I'm going to present. So
let's yes, maybe we can later. Actually continue it after your talk. That would be a pleasure, yes. Let's wait for that. Thanks for the questions.
So are there more questions?
Could I ask one quick thing, please? So earlier you had mentioned synchronous flux.
Mm-hmm.
Do you think that that the synchronization could be an intrinsic property when you're looking at time, or I don't know, that's as far as I got.
Whether it could be an intrinsic property. It depends a bit what one would call intrinsic. Maybe I would say that one important aspect of what I was trying to convey is somehow that you can really, let's say, this example of the spin clock would say here the synchronization is in a way intrinsic, because you could say, even if I only look at one clock and just know that it's perfectly, let's say, just regular, I mean, I describe it according to quantum theory and know this rotation is just according to a fixed gap between the energy levels, so it doesn't change, then I could say, okay, the fact that this clock has these spin ups in regular time distances mm-hmm. is just a property of the clock. I could say that I would nonetheless prefer not to think in that way. So actually another reason why we made this transition to go to two clocks is that we somehow want this whole thing to be also conceptually independent of T, because it should be independent of a background time. So in some way, I would say a clock. So maybe one way to answer your question would be, in my approach that which is maybe not completely visible here, but in my understanding, I would say if we had only one clock in the universe, this clock has essentially no property. I cannot say whether it's a good right. clock or a bad clock. I really need at least two copies of the same clock. And as soon as I have two copies, I can, for example, carry out this experiment. By the way, if I want to carry it out, I cannot do it like this. I really need the clock that outputs something, because otherwise I don't see anything. But I need at least two clocks. So my answer as a general physicist would be, no, one clock has no intrinsic properties of being synchronized. On the other hand, having said this, if I just restrict to ordinary, let's say, non-relativistic quantum theory, then I would say, yes, I could regard it as an intrinsic property, but I would prefer not to.
More than one clock, then we could say that synchronization occurs. So it is a property of the system which has more than one clock. Would yes. that be the right yes. way of putting it? Okay.
Yes. No, I'm really a big fan of all these work that has been done in the on quantum reference frames recently. I mean, of course, Flaminia, who I just see, has done a lot of work in this direction. And I think this is kind of in the spirit that if you just have one clock, there is no reference, but a clock can be a reference. So I didn't mention this, but one motivation, another completely different motivation for all this work for me is that if you look at this scenario, I really want to understand what does it mean to have a clock as a reference. And here you can say, for example, the green clock is a reference for the orange one in some way, to assess the quality of the orange one. And now we could potentially take results that have been derived in the context of reference frames and connect them to this scenario. That would be another thing that I actually plan to do at some point in the future. But there are too many things to be done, so I will not be able to do all of them.
Thank you.
Thanks a lot. So unless we have more questions, I think that we can thank Renato again for this very interesting and stimulating talk.
Thank you again for the invitation. It was really a pleasure. And thanks for the many questions.
Thank you.
Very nice question.
It was a very nice discussion.